I'm Sophia Smith-Gaylor.
And I'm Saatchi Paul.
And we're on a quest to find out where in the world women are living their best lives.
We're here to shine a light on some surprising and inspiring places and what we can learn from them.
Where to Be a Woman from the BBC World Service.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and in our conversations today on Focus on Africa, we're hearing from women who've experienced sexual violence in the ongoing conflict in Sudan.
For days and days, I've been saying to myself, why am I leaving? Why am I leaving? But Zara talks to me and says, what happened to you happened to a lot of people. You must be strong and positive.
The shortage of medicine in Ethiopia is so crucial, people don't know where to turn to get help.
We have to increase the prices almost every day because of the inflation, because of the shortage of foreign currency, and because there is a lot of fake medicines going around and people are suffering.
Also, we talked to the founders of an African animation company about their collaboration with the media giant Disney to create a film set in a futuristic Lagos. It's Thursday, the 21st of March. First, we go to Sudan. This is a very difficult story to listen to. It concerns the experiences of many women in Sudan right now. There's a war going on there, and the BBC has uncovered harrowing evidence of sexual violence and rape. Sudan has been torn apart by fighting between the country's military and their former allies, a paramilitary group called the Rapid Support Forces. This has been going on since last April. The United Nations says they've been hearing testimony that the Rapid Support Forces, whose origins lie in Arab militia groups, have been raping women and girls from Black African communities. We'll hear directly from two women whom we are calling Amina and Mariamu. Amina was a refugee from the Darfur region of Sudan. She's now pregnant after being raped. She wants to have an abortion and desperately hopes that her family won't find out. Mariamu was studying accounting before the war. She was raped by armed men right inside her home. When she called for help, they shot at her mother, who tried to save her. We pick up the story with Hala Al-Karib, a Sudanese human rights activist and the regional director of Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa Network. Hala, we're going to play you two clips of testimony. It's a little bit heavy going. I'm sure you've heard some of it as well, but I think let's go for it. It's Amina and Mariama.
Oh, right, go ahead.
The incident happened in Sudan. I'm not married and I had never been with a man except for the incident that happened. I didn't tell anyone and I don't think anyone knows. I just came to see a doctor because I did not have my period for 2 months and I have pain in my abdomen. The militia caught me with my aunts and cousins. They escaped, but I was kept for a whole day. There was two of them. One raped me many times before I managed to escape.
For days and days, I've been saying to myself, why am I leaving? Why am I leaving? But Zara talks to me and says, what happened to you happened to a lot of people. You must be strong and positive. After that, I could not walk. My mom took some stuff from the house and we left with my grandmother. People were running, but we could not because my grandmother cannot run. I was also bleeding. We managed to flee, but I'm not feeling okay. I'm not happy. I'm really traumatized. They're doing that because they're trying to spoil our dignity, because they are taking us as their enemies.
Hala, that was very difficult to hear and imagine the massive trauma that the women who actually experienced it are going through. Your reaction?
Absolutely. So, as painful as it is since April 15 and before that, you know, this is the stories that we have been living with and we have been constantly hearing from women. sexual violence against women and girls in Sudan, it's not new, despite the fact that the scale of sexual violence has exacerbated significantly after April 15. You know, it became a nightmare. This is being said for 20 years. Women in rural Darfur have struggled with sexual violence. Even in cities in Darfur, they have struggled with sexual violence. Right now, what we are seeing in Jenina and what's happening in Khartoum and many parts of Jazeera is absolutely the consequences of the silence and, I would say, complacency about the fact that women bodies were allowed to be used for decades. And right now, we are struggling with the same silence. And I'm very, very grateful for the BBC and for other media for raising these issues. Because as women activists and as women leaders who speaks about this issue, just like the survivors that we have just heard, we feel very lonely and very painful because we try to amplify their voices, but we are up against a structure, first of all, does not provide support or help. Secondly, it doesn't acknowledge that sexual violence is actually the central in Sudan's conflict. It's the main feature of Sudan conflict.
Tell me what you mean when you say the structure. What or who are you talking about that doesn't want to acknowledge and doesn't offer support?
First of all, you know, the perpetrators, the RSF, they are using sexual violence as a war strategy. They have been using sexual violence as a war strategy, and that did not stop at all.
So this is the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces, right?
Absolutely. But also, the Sudan military staff, Sudan Armed Forces, does not enable survivors to access services in areas of their control as it should be, nor they do provide protection as it should be.
Are the RSF the only ones committing this and not the Sudan Armed Forces?
Sudan Armed Forces does not exist on the ground most of the time. There is territories where Sudan Armed Forces or some other army groups, you know, who are affiliated with Sudan Armed Forces in very specific locations, they could be implicated in sexual violence. However, for us, a civil society working on the ground, over 90% of the cases that we have documented, it was committed by RSF soldiers, happened inside RSF-controlled territories or territories that was invaded by RSF. But lastly, the fact that sexual violence is part of this conflict and it is perpetrated by the RSF, this conversation is not part of their political narrative or political discourse.
Are there specific women targeted besides the fact that they live in mostly, as you're saying, RSF-controlled areas? Are all women in Sudan subject to this kind of violence, or are there very specifically targeted women?
Sudan right now is not a safe country for women, regardless of where you live. Your exposure to rape and sexual violence or abuse or torture as a woman is quite prevalent. Being targeted for your gender is quite prevalent. But absolutely, women who are living in RSF-controlled areas are at an extremely high risk and exposure to sexual violence. And that's happening on a daily basis. The RSF right now is controlling four of the four states. And those are dense population areas. Women and girls, particularly girls, are quite exposed to sexual violence. So when I say girls, I'm talking about little girls as 10 years old. They are exposed to those heinous crimes.
We've been hearing that it's most of the people targeted are Black African women. Is that true?
It was, yes, that was the truth, absolutely, in Darfur. The Darfur is ethnic profiling is critical on targeting with sexual violence. Indigenous Darfur tribes absolutely are targeted by sexual violence. Indigenous Africans groups are more subjected to sexual violence. But right now, for example, in places like in Jazeera or in Khartoum, all women are targeted. You know, women who are from indigenous African tribes, absolutely.
So what happens to women and girls that are assaulted in this way? You've said that the army isn't providing any kind of support for them. They're waging a war, making it impossible for people to access these kinds of facilities. But are there organizations that are trying to help?
The problem is there is so little support for Sudan. People, they keep saying that Sudan crisis is a forgotten crisis. But I would say, I'd argue that Sudan crisis is a neglected crisis. It's a crisis that nobody actually is investing on it. You know, so the level of support and the level of aid in terms of access to sexual reproductive health, access to the protocol post-rape is literally non-existing. And as civil society, we have to rely on ourselves. We have to rely on our local networks to be able to extend support to survivors, but our capacity is very limited and our outreach is very limited. And until now, the international aid support is not set up and is not in place yet to aid survivors of sexual violence. And this is why, sadly and heartbroken, we hear stories about so many girls committing suicide. They are taking off their lives. So many girls are slipping away in a very serious mental health challenges. Add to that the issue of the stigma, the issue of the silence. People, they don't talk. You know how complicated it is, sexual violence. Sexual violence, it takes, you know, sometimes people, they don't talk for months. You know, sometimes it takes years. So there is a lot of people who are living with this, and it's really costing a lot. But the lack of services is absolutely, lack of safe access to services is highly problematic. Yeah.
It is. And I'm sorry that you have to talk about this to us. And it's a real sadness to hear what's happening to women in Sudan.
You know, I hear those little girls, you know, and they speak to you. Whatever I'm saying, you know, it's nothing against their pain and what they are going through. This is the least we can do. So thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Halal Kharib, the regional director of the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa Network. Ethiopians are really going through the most at the moment. The aftermath of the vicious war in Tigray, continued conflict in the Amhara region, and a serious cost of living crisis is making life incredibly difficult. One of the most serious effects of the shortages brought about by disrupted supply chains is a severe shortage of medicine. Girum Gebede is a pharmacist in Addis Ababa.
In our case, we open our pharmacy at 8 a.m. By the time we get there are 30 or 40 people every day. So we serve them first come first. And most of the time, the people who are in line, they go home without any medicine because the shelves will be empty. We have to increase the prices almost every day because of the inflation, because of the shortage of foreign currency, and because there is a lot of contraband, fake medicines going around, and people are suffering.
Like so many countries, Ethiopia depends on imported goods. Medicines are included in that. So when dollars are scarce, the things you need to pay for in dollars are also scarce. Samuel Getachew is a journalist in Ethiopia, and he's experienced the drug shortage firsthand in his own family. He's been explaining to me how it came to this.
Well, the country is running out of forex, according to the government. They only have less than $1 billion for their export needs, and much of the things that Ethiopians consume on a daily basis is brought from outside. So with no forex, most of the pharmacies are running out of medicine, and many people are being forced to either take a local medicine that hasn't been verified or that's substandard, or are forced to pay highly exaggerated prices for some of the medicine that are coming from mostly Western countries.
give us an idea of what kinds of medicines are not available and how people are going about trying to get them.
Anything from basic medicine, vitamin supplements, to sophisticated medicines for cancer and HIV, for anything. There are some NGOs that provide, for instance, some medicine. But again, the population of Ethiopia is at least 120 million, with the majority of people dependent on some kind of support from the government, either wanting subsidized medicine or looking for cheaper medicine, even from private pharmacies. And with an economy that's, in the downturn, with endless conflicts happening all over the country, I mean, the country is going through a catch-22 moment.
And you are personally affected by this, right?
I have been. When my father was sick, unfortunately, he passed on in August 2022. We had to bring his medicine from Canada. And sometimes we'd run out of medicine and we'd be calling people that are coming in, even connecting with the Ethiopian Airlines hostesses and pilots to try to help us bring this medicine. And there were moments when we had run away and we couldn't get his medicine on a timely basis, but we tried. And we're the very lucky ones among millions of Ethiopians that do not have that kind of connection. And even my cousin, who needed vitamin supplements in the last year, had to pay highly exaggerated prices from someone selling those medicines because there was no pharmacy that had those medicines. And even when you walk into pharmacies, they offer you, they ask you, they've run out of medicine, but then they offer you expensive medicines if you can afford it. That's where we are at the moment in Ethiopia.
This has been going on for quite a while now. You say your father died in 2022, and before that, you had this struggle on your hands.
Yes. I mean, Ethiopia has always been struggling in terms of having enough forex to spend on this kind of resources, but it has really gotten worse since the conflict began. Because all of a sudden, the priority of the Ethiopian society or Ethiopian government was conflicts, endless conflicts. And some of the investors that were providing forex to the economy are either they've suspended their operation in Ethiopia or have run away. So that really reflects poorly in terms of providing the needed resources to the population that are really in a desperate situation. There are many, many people that are living with no medicine because they can't afford it. There's no medicine for them, and government cannot either provide them subsidized medicine or pharmacies cannot sell them at a cost. So many people are really, really suffering. It's a uniform-like problem, and it's even worse when you go outside of Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia.
You say many people are living without medicine. I'm imagining that lots of people are dying because they don't have medicine.
I'm sure. The cost of conflicts, the cost of an economy that's going down, the price that this country is paying, it's invisible mostly. And I can only talk about the people I've seen, the people I've met, mostly in Addis Ababa. You can only imagine what's happening in other countries. For instance, in Amhara region, there's a conflict. Even if you have the medicine, you can't access much of the population. And the little medicine they can have access to, it's being sold in highly exaggerated prices, just like what we're seeing in Addis Ababa. And this is a situation where Ethiopia is at the moment.
Do you know of anybody who may have died because they didn't have the right medicine and couldn't afford it?
I have, on a personal note, I've tried to be accessible. I've tried to cover my family's need whenever I travel in places like Kenya, which is in a better situation. But earlier this year, in December and in January, I offered through social media to bring medicine to anyone who is in need. And the need was overwhelming. I was able to bring some medicine, but the kind of stories I was hearing is really heartbreaking. And you can clearly tell people are hurting, and I'm sure the worst is happening. But I haven't been able to verify anyone who may have died with the lack of medicine, but I'm assuming there are many people who may have died as a result.
Tell us a little bit about the response that you got when you posted on X Twitter offering to bring medicine from people. Some of the harrowing stories that you have just been talking about. Can you tell us a little bit?
Some were cancer patients who needed scarce medicine to actually survive. Some needed basic supplements, vitamin supplements. Some had diabetes and so on.
I think we had 24 people approach me, asking me to support them. We did support them. A person who works in one of the NGOs offered to cover some of the costs, and we were able to support about a dozen of them. But since my story came out in Semaphore, I've been offered another assistance from Australia, willing to bring some medicine to those people that we weren't able to support. But this is a glimpse of what's happening in Ethiopia, and many people are hoping something will change, because again, the cost of war and conflicts and an economy that's in the downturn, as I mentioned to you, is really having an impact on the population.
So what's the government's reaction, and what is their plan for this? Because it's unsustainable. You can't have people dying from a lack of medicine or suffering from a lack of medicine, or people taking substandard medicine and endangering their lives in that way, surely.
Well, a year ago, the minister who's in charge of medicine or industry, Ministry of Industry, came out and said the intention is to try to force local manufacturers to get into the business of producing things like medicine. But it's been a year. I wonder how successful it's been, because I still see lines of people at pharmacies, especially government pharmacies. Whenever I visit local hospitals, well, as I always do for different stories I work for as a freelance journalist, I see more people in worse situation that I found them a year ago. But the government is insisting things will change, and they will offer support to local manufacturers. And I don't know if that's going to be a lofty dream or a reality. That's yet to be seen.
Why would Ethiopian manufacturers have to be forced to make these medicines? Surely it goes without saying, it's a no-brainer. People need medicine. Medicine is not coming into the country. Is the government offering them incentives to do it, or are they going out on a limb and having to risk taking the step?
I'll give you an example. A year and a half ago, the government decided not to give Forex access to a number of companies that bring in things like cars, expensive TVs, perfumes, and so on. But they also said they're going to focus on forcing these companies, instead of focusing on such a business, to focus, have them focus on manufacturing products the country needs. While this looks good on a piece of paper or perhaps at a press conference, but in reality, many people tend to, you know, value medicines that are brought from outside, because they fear that what's manufactured in Ethiopia might be substandard. So the government still has some work to do trying to convince what's produced locally is as good as what's produced outside. But we haven't been able to see any of the local medicines that are being produced as a result of the forex shortage that brought this problem to the forefront. But the government is wishing things will change, but they haven't really put any plan to serve or bring what's needed to much of the population. You only have to visit, you know, some of the pharmacies to see the hardship that many people are facing at the moment.
So are people suffering in silence, or are there, you know, visible and audible protests about this? Because if your loved ones are dying because the country can't provide, surely it makes people very unhappy.
Well, protest is not the norm of the country. But people tend to suffer, or people tend to protest in silence. The reason that many people are heading to other countries, for instance, the reason at least 1 million people are signing up on a government program to be going to countries like Saudi Arabia, UAE, and so on, or even Lebanon, is to really escape the hardship they're facing at the moment. Among the many hardship that they're facing is the lack of medicine to theirs and their loved ones. And they see a chance at going to some other countries, so they won't have to face the daily hardship that many of them or their family members are facing at the moment. That gives you a glimpse of what's really happening in the country.
Samuel, thank you very, very much for talking to
us
about this. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Samuel Getachew is a journalist based in Addis Ababa. So have you watched Iwaju yet? If you have, what did you think? And if you haven't, what are you waiting for? Well, I'm one of those who hasn't yet. but it's a 6-part animation series which can be found on Disney Plus or on DSTV. Iwaju means the future in Yoruba, and it uses Nigerian pidgin spoken by Nigerian actors. It is set in a future Lagos, a city that has embraced technological advancements while retaining a solid sense of its Nigerian identity. It was launched a couple of weeks ago and is a rare collaboration between Disney Plus, the streaming platform, and an external production company, and an African one at that. The company in question is Kugali, which is led by 3 friends from Nigeria and Uganda who wanted to boost African animation. Richard Kagoe spoke to 2 of the co-founders, Tolu Olowofoyeku and Olufikayo Sigi Adiola. Where and how did it all begin?
I'd say the genesis of the idea came from me. So even though what you ultimately see on screen now in Disney Plus is the product of many, many different hands, I was the one who first pitched the idea to Tolu and Hamid, and then we refined it a little bit more before we then pitched it to Disney.
I'm wondering how you managed to convince Disney that there should be a collaboration. How did you do this?
They saw the vision, they saw the quality, they saw the passion, the dedication, the quality of storytelling. So by the time they're taking the opportunity to know us, they really felt like we want to collaborate with these guys because they'd never really done a collaboration like this before. But I think that it was just a match made in heaven.
Tolu, because you're the cultural consultant for this series, I'm very curious to know exactly what sort of consultancy you were doing for this.
Okay, so for one thing, it was quite easy because I was working with my co-founders. We had already been working together for a while. And Fikayo is from Lagos, Nigeria as well. So he already knows Lagos to an extent. The difference is he relocated to the UK when he was about 15. And even though he's back in Lagos maybe 2-3 times almost every single year, his experience is different from mine because I actually live here. I've been here all my life. So Fikayo might write something and then be trying to remember, hey, Tolu, how does this still track? When I was a kid in Lagos, I remember something like this. Do people still do that in Lagos? Or how would someone say this? Or what's the word for that? So let's say it starts with Fikayo consulting me, which is something we were already doing when we worked on comics anyway. But then on the larger scale, I was responsible for just educating everyone who was not from Lagos, Nigeria, but worked on the project, which includes other Africans, because Kugali has artists in Uganda, Zimbabwe, and we brought these artists onto the project. And then obviously Disney Animation brought even more artists than we did because they have so many artists in Burbank. And Cinesite brought then a lot of people in Canada. So my job was just to make sure everybody who might not be familiar with Lagos got all the little details right.
I'm just wondering how Disney was open to the proposal of a role specifically just focusing on cultural consultancy. What was that like?
Oh, wow. Fikayo, do you remember? I honestly don't remember like at what point we decided that was my role. Because Hamid, Fikayo, and I worked on the pitches, on all 3 pitches. We pitched multiple stories. We worked on all 3 pitches together, even though Fikayo wrote all of them because he's the one who's like an actual writer. Fikayo, yeah, what do you remember?
I don't remember exactly, I'm not sure if I have this exactly correct, but what I remember is that the moment it was decided that Iwaju was going to be the story that we were going to develop into a TV series, I don't know if the suggestion came from me or the suggestion came from you, because some of the ideas we pitched didn't necessarily have a lot of Nigerian culture in it. Oh, I mean, certainly they didn't have any Lagos culture in it. Therefore, had we gone with one of those ideas, I mean, Tolu would definitely have still made a significant contribution, but the role would have been more unclear. But because we really wanted this story to be deeply, deeply rooted in Lagos right from the get-go, even when we were developing the pitch, I remember Tolu and Hamid going on a long back and forth about certain things Hamid wanted to include in the pitch and whatnot. But point being is that at some point, I don't know if the suggestion came from me or Tolu, that the way he'd be able to bring the most value to this project would be to be a sort of guardrail or present sort of guardrails and helping us ensure that this project remained authentic. I think Disney were the ones who suggested the specific cultural consultant title, but I had known from a very early on that if we were to go with Iwaju Tolu, it would be integral in helping us maintain its authenticity.
I just wonder, were there any concessions that had to be made at some point? Any compromises?
Yeah, a lot of compromises, but more from the stories telling, like the actual story, not the cultural bits. Disney really wanted to get the cultural bits right. But then when it comes to the story, Fikayo will talk more about this, but he eventually had a co-writer on the project because he was also the director. You know, sometimes directorial duties wouldn't give him enough time to do the 205th rewrite on the script. So he got a co-writer. So there were definitely some conflicts.
Yes, I don't think it's possible to do a project on this scale without making certain compromises, certain concessions. It's very similar. I sometimes use the analogy of it's like being in a relationship, so to speak, where if you want to move forward with the person that you're with, you're going to have to sometimes let certain things go and make certain compromises. But the spirit in which you approach that kind of thing, it is for like mutual benefit and development. So I think there wasn't a single area, even like in terms of like the visuals, the story, even presenting Nigerian culture to an American company, that created many different avenues for, I think, either not quite understanding it in the beginning, so avenues for like misunderstanding, avenues for creative differences. So the short answer is yes.
You pointed out that there were no any sort of like, significant changes, especially when it came to the cultural aspect of it. I wonder how this has been received in Nigeria. Could you just paint the picture for me?
The way it's been received in Nigeria, I've seen two versions. There are the people whose minds are just blown that we got all the little details. Like, I saw a video on Instagram where this lady was just on episode one alone, she was just pointing out all the little details, the interlocking tiles on the floor of the main character's house, the different types of flowers in that house that were also very accurate, the girl waking up with a bonnet on her head, all those little details. She was so mind blown. But I've noticed most of those people tend to be people in the diaspora who are looking back at Nigeria like, hey, I remember this, I remember this. Oh my God, that's so accurate. Oh, they're speaking pidgin. But then many people in Nigeria, you know, like when you're actually in the midst of it, you might not appreciate it as much. I think many people in Nigeria tend to think, wait, these people are trying to tell me this story is set 100 years in the future, but A still exists, B still exists. Problem C that we have in real life, that problem is still in Lagos 100 years from now. Come on, give me a break. So many Nigerians who actually live in Nigeria tend not to be as impressed. However, I think like many of them, if they actually just got to speak with us and know like why we took those steps, they would appreciate it better. Because for one thing, while many people feel like, hey, how come ABC still exists 100 years in the future? No, we actually hope many of those problems no longer exist 100 years in the future. But we decided to design this world not idealistically, like what we want Lagos to look like, but rather take elements that already exist in Lagos that people can recognize and just exaggerate it into the future. So dial it all the way to 11. So that was a design choice and not a statement of this is what we hope Lagos will look like.
You know, I just came across this online with somebody called Zikoko, and the blogger, you know, writes this: voice acting has always been my biggest issue with Nigerian animation, and to its credit, most of the voice acting in Iwaju isn't bad. However, when the characters want to speak Pidgin or even Yoruba, the results are awkward to say the least. Tola gets off easy since it's established that she's sheltered, but Kole is supposed to be the guy from Ajegunle. His Pidgin shouldn't sound so odd. I wonder what your reaction to this tiny criticism.
So I've seen that blog post, and Zikoko as a brand typically likes to post tongue-in-cheek articles, which are not to be taken too seriously.
One thing I will also say as well, and this sort of alludes to a question that you had asked earlier about compromises, is that there were certain lines that, especially with the pidgin, there are certain lines that we had to really exaggerate, especially with the level of eloquence that the line was read with. in order to make sure that it was really, really audible for a global audience. So I do think that was part of the consequence of this being like such a global collaboration. I remember there's some lines specifically where we would get notes of, oh, can he read it? Not necessarily changing the accent, but can he really like elocute certain words so that you're talking? So if I'm really trying to talk to somebody who doesn't speak English, so I'm speaking slowly as I'm doing now, someone who is a fluent English speaker might listen to the way I'm talking and be like, why is he talking like that? That seems a little bit strange. So there is a little bit of that in the show with certain lines that certain people who were reviewing the show pointed out as, oh, I don't really understand this, or can that be reread? So I would say that there is something a little bit to that in that particular avenue.
Like Zeki said, we definitely did have to adjust certain things before the global audience. And if you think about it, even when you watch, let's say, cartoons in America on maybe Cartoon Network or something, the way the characters speak, you would be like, that's not actually how real people would speak even in America. But it's a cartoon, so they have to like make certain phrases more dramatic or more pronounced, or just, you know, cater to the audience a bit better.
Tolu and Fikayo, thank you so much for your time. It was great having you on Focus on Africa podcast.
Thank you. Thank you
very much. Thank you so much.
Richard was talking to Kugali founders Tolu Olowofoyeku and Olufikayo Zigi Adiola. Focus on Africa was put together by Sunita Nahar, Yvette Twagira Maria, and Richard Kagoe. Carney Sharp pulled it all together. Johnny Hall was our technical producer. Our editors are Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.
Hi, Namulanta Kombo here with some very exciting news. My award-winning podcast, Dear Daughter, is back for a new series. I'm putting together a handbook to life for daughters everywhere, collecting letters from listeners from all over the world, full of stories and advice to help navigate life. And I'm joined by some very special guests, sharing their experiences and words of wisdom too. That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.